very well, and some hotels on the south coast, where he went in fine weather to have lunch or to get his hair cut. This last detail, given me quite innocently by Mr. Phillips one day, added long, lank hair to the dark glassed and otherwise formally suited recluse of my fantasy. I saw my landlord being at once pushed and supported into the lobby of some Victorian hotel by Mr. Phillips, Mr. Phillips holding on with both hands to the left arm of his charge, while the free right hand of my landlord blindly groped. Neither picture, neither the man I thought I had seen nor the man I had invented, answered to what I was told about my landlord by people in London who knew him and sometimes came to visit him. That other man, coming to me in fragments, as it were, remained far away. A pampered childhood, here, in the grounds where I now walked about. In the cold shade of the overgrown orchard there was a round, two-story children's house, solidly built, thatched, and still more or less whole, though the surrounding vegetation was partly strangled and decayed, as in true forest. In the room downstairs there was a real fireplace, with inset stone or concrete shelves in the wall on either side, and with ladder steps to the upper room, which had dormer windows in the conical thatched roof. More than a doll's house, on a grand scale, and yet less than a child's playhouse, an adult's idea, rather, of a children's house, with nothing left to the imagination. After that pampered, protected childhood, a young manhood of artistic talent and promise, and of social frivolity, I was shown photographs of those days both by Mr. Phillips and by Bray, the car hire man whose father had worked all his life at the manor. Bray lived in the flint and brick cottage his father had bought long ago from the estate, but though Bray was now independent of the manor and proud of it, refusing even to serve people in the manor, he had all kinds of manor souvenirs to show, and he liked showing them. Blurred black-and-white photographs of parties in the grounds, the gardens not yet grown, undergrown. Photographs of young people sitting in uncertain light, dusk or dawn, on the rails of new timber bridges over the creeks in the water meadows. Photographs, snapshots, melancholy in their effect, each snapshot capturing a moment of time with all its unconsidered details, forcing one to think of the tract of time that had followed, and being a kind of memento mori, in the way a good painting of the same occasion, charged with the spirit and labour of the painter, would never have been. Then in early middle age, after the parties, after the Second War, a disturbance of some sort, a morbid, lasting depression, almost an illness, resulting in withdrawal, hiding, a retreat to the manor, complicated after a while by physical disorders and, finally, age. I was his opposite in every way, social, artistic, sexual, and considering that his family's fortune had grown but enormously, with the spread of the empire in the 19th century, it might be said that an empire lay between us. This empire at the same time linked us. This empire explained my birth in the New World, the language I used, the vocation and ambition I had. This empire in the end explained my presence there in the valley, in the cottage, in the grounds of the manor. But we were, or had started, at opposite ends of wealth, privilege, and in the hearts of different cultures. 20 years before, when I was trying to write at the Earl's Court boarding house, residence in the grounds of the manor would have seemed suitable, material. But the imperial link would then have been burdensome. It would have tormented me as a man, or boy, to be a racial oddity in the valley, and I would have been able, as a writer at that time, to deal with the material only by suppressing certain aspects of myself, the very kind of suppression and concealment that narrative of a certain sort encouraged, and which had led me, even as an observer, eager for knowledge and experience, to miss much. But the world had changed. Time had moved on. I had found my talent and my subject ever unfolding and developing. My career had changed. My ideas had changed. And coming to the manor at a time of disappointment and wounding, I felt an immense sympathy for my landlord who, starting at the other end of the world, now wished to hide, like me. I felt a kinship with him, was deeply grateful for the protection of the manor, for the style of things there. I never thought his seclusion strange. It was what I wanted for myself at that time. I wanted, when I came to the manor after the pride of ambition, to strip my life down. I wanted to live as far as possible with what I found in the cottage, in the manor grounds, to alter as little as possible. I wanted to avoid vanity, and for me then vanity could lie in various small things, like wishing to buy an ashtray. Why a special ashtray, when the empty tobacco tin could serve? So I felt in tune with what I saw or thought I saw at the manor. I felt in myself the same spirit of withdrawal, and though I knew that men might arrive at similar states or attitudes for dissimilar reasons and by different routes, and as men might even be incompatible, I felt at one with my landlord. Privilege lay between us, but I had an intimation that it worked against him. Whatever my spiritual state at the moment of arrival, I knew I would have to save myself and look for health. I knew I would have to act at some time. His privilege, his house, his staff, his income, the acres he could look out at every day knew to be his. This privilege could press him down into himself, into non-doing and nullity. So though we had started at opposite ends of empire and privilege, and in different cultures, it was easy for me as his tenant now to feel goodwill in my heart for him. I never thought it odd or creepy, to use the word given me by Alan, a literary visitor, that I never saw my landlord. His wish to be unseen by me was matched by my wish not to be seen by him, a remnant of my old colonial racial nerves. But I was also nervous of undoing the magic of the place. If I had seen my landlord, heard his voice, heard his conversation, seen his face and expression, been constrained to make conversation back, to be polite, the impression would have been ineffaceable. He would have been endowed with a character, with vanities, irritations, absurdities, and this would have led me to make judgments, the judgments that undoing acceptance can also undo a relationship. As it was, the personality of my landlord was expressed for me by the mystery of the manor and the grounds. The manor grounds grew on me. Unused to the seasons, in the way I have described, and, so far as architecture went, still perhaps tending to take things too much for granted, seeing ordinary buildings too much as natural expressions of a particular place, it took me time to understand what I was seeing. It took me time to see that my cottage, in spite of its name, was not a simple building. It was a long, low building on two levels. There was a slight graded slope from the road to the water meadows and the river. It was at the far side of the lawn or manor green. Whatever my mood and however long or short my separation from the cottage, whether I had gone on an overseas assignment of many months, or had simply gone to Salisbury, or had gone for my afternoon walk, the first sight of the cottage on my return, breaking in upon me at the end of the short, dark lane from the public road, never failed to delight and surprise me. The lane from the public road was overhung with yew, and summer added the layer upon layer shade of beech and copper beech, so that even while I was in that gloom, the openness of the lawn and the soft, warm colours of the cottage were visible. I felt delight at the long, low shape of the building set right against the beeches. The roots of one or two beeches began just beyond the cottage wall, and yet, for some reason, there was never any shifting or subsidence of the cottage foundations. I felt delight at the setting, the naturalness, the rightness, and surprised that this was where I lived. It took me time to understand that this was no country naturalness, that the cottage had been designed to create just that effect. The walls were thick, perhaps rubble-filled, but on the surface they were a considered mixture of flint and brickbats and warm yellow stone, and once I saw the design and the intention, I also saw that the masonry was craftsman's work. One day, on a block of stone set high up on a side wall, I saw the carved initials of the builder or designer. The last initial proclaimed him a member of my landlord's family, with the year 1911. Play, from someone of the family, in that secure, far-off year, the coronation year of the King Emperor George V. With my instinct to accept what I found, it took me time to recognize the element of play and the extent of it in the ordering of the manor grounds. A short yew hedge separated my cottage from a small, single-roomed wooden building, unpainted and now weathered grey-black. This building, square in plan and taller than my cottage, was extravagantly rustic in style. The walls were of thick, rough, sawn planks. The lower edge of the planks kept the shape and the bark of the trunk from which they had been sawn. The whole structure rested on mushroom-shaped stones. I thought that this fanciful house, or shed, was intended by the builder, whether it was the same member of the family who had built my cottage I didn't know, to be the forester's hut, in the play settlement or village around the lawn or manor green. Until one summer afternoon in my third or fourth year, Pitten, the gardener, coming back after lunch in a relaxed mood, opened the weathered door to show me. And how easily and sturdily that door swung open, though the building had not been used for years. What I had thought of as the forester's hut was no such thing. It had been a stable. It even had a hay loft. There was still hay in the loft, and there were still ropes and harness hanging on nails, and leather and trappings connected with horses, and still a smell of horse, and a timber floor quite clean below the cobwebs. Everything was weathered outside. Inside, and the wooden house or box was much taller and bigger than it seemed from the outside, everything was protected, in spite of the starlings that besieged it at certain times, and especially for 2 or 3 weeks in the spring. A stable, like a forester's hut, I allowed my fantasy to persist, and across the lawn a squash court built to look like a farmhouse, its apparently rough walls as carefully thought out as the walls of my own cottage. Next to that were the rough timbered garages or wagon sheds, and then the antique, ivy-covered, flint-walled storehouse or granary whose back formed part of the churchyard wall. So that after the spaciousness of the downs and the water meadows, the country openness, there was suddenly here a remnant and a reminder of medieval huddle and constriction. And just as, along the droveway, the modernity of the old farm manager's bungalow was set next to the antiquity of the worn, striated slopes, so here, the modern fantasy of my cottage and the forester's hut and the farmhouse was set next to, ran into, the Middle Ages. And yet it made a whole. It worked. You could take it all for granted, as I had done at the beginning, and see it as something that went with an Edwardian big house in this part of the country. Or you could enter the fantasy, a child's vision made concrete, child's play by an adult or adults. Extraordinary. This gratuitous expression of great security and wealth in this corner of an estate that once was so much bigger, and far from places like Trinidad, where the word estate, when I first got to know it, especially if it was a sugar estate, didn't hold any idea of grandeur or style, carrying connotations instead only of size and sameness, and many small lives and small houses at the edges. And yet it was this element of play, the child's play of the toy settlement around the manor green or lawn, which, when I recognized it, I yielded to. Across the lane from the forester's hut, and visible from the side window of my cottage, was what looked like a little country cottage on its own. It was really a shed, built against the wall of the manor's vegetable garden, but it had been designed like a half-cottage, a cottage sliced down through the middle from the ridge of the roof, to suggest, from certain angles, a cottage with a door and a window. The lane that ran around this settlement and its green was lined with mushroom-shaped stones. These stones, I was told, were a local feature. Barns used to be built on them to keep the rats out. They had kept the rats out of the stable, the forester's hut. But it was their decorative, fairy-tale quality that was exploited here. Every mushroom stone had been made to look different from every other. The tops were chipped differently, and sometimes the supports were carved into a curve. Over the years, many of these mushrooms had been damaged. They were too delicate a fantasy. Many of the mushroom tops had, in fact, disappeared, been got out of the way, and even some of the supporting stones had been knocked flat. But, by a miracle, outside my cottage door, on the lane side in front of the wall of the vegetable garden, there had been preserved 5 or 6 of these mushrooms as they had been originally designed. The tops chipped into different degrees of thickness, chipped rough, each mushroom top supporting a little moss forest in winter. This was the fantasy to which I returned, the many-featured fantasy of manor, manor village around its green manor garden, and always felt welcomed by, in that first winter, while I was working on my book. It was the fantasy of the original builder or builders, the family fantasy which my landlord had inherited and which now, I felt, as I entered more and more into it, best expressed his character. The rest of the grounds, the orchard, the garden at the back of the main house, the water meadows, the walk along the river, all of that came later, in the late spring or early summer, when I was ill and couldn't do the long walks along the driveway. This was the time I learned to fix that particular season, to give it certain associations of flowers, trees, river. After I had finished my book, the one with the African centrepiece, I had gone abroad to do some journalism, for the money, the travel out of England, and the spiritual refreshment. The assignments had been exhausting, the second in a place not served by many airlines. I had fallen ill on the slow journey back, through many climates, and in one place had spent 4 days and nights in a hotel room in a stupor of ache and sleep. I was light-headed when I returned to the valley and the cottage. I felt its welcoming quality, its protectiveness, and was moved by the unearthly beauty, as it seemed to me, of every growing thing around my cottage. The peonies below the sitting-room windows made an especial impression. My fantasies, both waking and sleeping, constantly played with the shapes of these developing, tight, round, dark red buds. The doctor found nothing seriously wrong with me, no infection of lung or blood. He said I was tired. He said, and we were in a military area, battle fatigue. And as the weeks passed, that indeed was what my illness seemed to resolve itself into, a great tiredness, not unpleasant, a tiredness with a little delirium that, alas, too rarely, had come to me as a child with a tropical fever. This fever associated with the chill of the rainy season, the season of extravagant, dramatic weather, of interruptions in routine, of days off from school because of rain and floods, and the coughs and fevers to which they gave rise. How often, as a child, having had my fever, I had longed to have it all over again, to experience all the distortions of perceptions it brought about, the extraordinary sense of smoothness, not only to one's touch, but also in one's mouth and stomach. And, with that, voices and noises becoming oddly remote and exciting. I had never had fever as often as I would have liked. Instead, very soon as I had grown up, fever had been replaced by the real misery of bronchitis and asthma, exhausting afflictions without a good side. Now, in my welcoming cottage, deliciously, for the first time since my childhood, I felt I was having fever, exhaustion, work, travel had brought it on. The doctor's diagnosis felt true. In my welcoming cottage, hidden by layer upon layer of beech and yew from the public road, I began to feel oppressed by the labours and strains of the last 20 years. The strains connected with writing, that passion, the personal strains as well that had begun that day when the Pan-American World Airways plane had taken me up and shown me that pattern of the fields I had been surrounded by as a child in Trinidad, but had never seen till that moment. All the work, all the strain, all the disappointments and recoveries now seemed to sit in a solid mass in my head. But I had no vision now of being a corpse at the bottom of a river, no dream of an exploding head that left me shaken up, exhausted after a struggle to wake. All the stress had turned to fever, so that in my welcoming cottage I was like a child again, as though I had at last, after 20 years, travelled to the equivalent of the fantasy I had had in mind when I left home. And it was in this mood that when I recovered sufficiently to go outside, I began, with the encouragement of Mr. and Mrs. Phillips, who asked me to dismiss the idea that I might be trespassing on my landlord's privacy, to explore the spring of the overgrown garden, the spring that had begun for me and had been fixed for me, by the peony pushing up tight, swelling buds on rhubarb-like stalks below the sitting-room window of my cottage. In my 20 years off and on in England, I must have seen many thousands of peonies. They were a common flower, as I was to see when I was fit enough to take bus rides into Salisbury. Right through the valley, in open, sun-struck gardens, small and large, country cottage or suburban-style gardens, I saw them blooming away too fast in bright light, losing their tightness and deep colour, rapidly losing their virtue. None of the many thousands I had seen before this spring had made an impression on me. I had never been able to put the name peony to any of them. I had never been able to attach them to a season, or a time of year, or to the appearance of other flowers, or to other natural events. These peonies of my convalescence, these peonies around my cottage were my first, and they stood for my new life. The clump outside the sitting-room window was on the north of the cottage. There was another clump in the shade of the yew hedge between my cottage and the forester's hut. They came out slowly, preserving their shape, developing an especially deep colour. From the lane below the yews and the beeches, the peonies of my cottage made two deep points of colour in an otherwise green expanse, edged with wilderness. Once there were 16 gardeners. Now there was only Pitten. He grew vegetables in the walled garden. There he also grew certain flowers for the manor and my landlord. He looked after a private lawn of my landlord's somewhere else in the grounds. He was like Jack, marking out and maintaining areas of cultivation in the midst of wasteland. But much of what Pitten did was hidden from me. What I saw was mainly wilderness, through which, once or twice in the season, Pitten would cut, for him and me, the narrowest of paths, quite literally. One swath up, one swath down. This two-swathed path of Pitten's began at the end of the lawn, almost opposite the shaded lane that led from the public road. The path ran through an enclosure, hedged with old box, unpruned, grown out now almost into trees, meeting above the entrance to make an arch, almost as if that had been intended. The enclosure was empty, without any sign of old planting or old flower beds. In one corner a sycamore had been planted, or had seeded itself. There were a number of sycamores about, growing apparently at random, and on this sycamore, a tree now rather than a sapling, someone had trailed a wisteria vine, itself now an old thing, speaking of the old days and the many gardeners, and of people having the time and means and wish to embellish a hidden corner. In the winter, the enclosure had been full of the dried-up stalks of weeds, sometimes as tall as dried maize plants, and clumps of thin, long-bladed grass. Now the weeds on succulent, thick, green stalks were growing tall again. But in spite of those weeds and the wild grass, the path Pitten had cut, one swath up, one swath down, showed grass as tight and fine and level as the grass of a lawn, as though the wilderness was only on the surface and awaited only this cut, to reveal the old order and beauty and many seasons tending that lay beneath. This enclosure seemed to be part of the garden of the manor, but I was told by Bray, the car hire man, that it was older, and the overgrown box hedge suggested a greater age. The enclosure belonged to the house that was here before the manor, Bray said, and he said that before that there had been a monastery or nunnery on the site. The idea was not a fantastic one. In medieval times everything would have lain along the little river just a few miles away at Amesbury, where the river went wide and shallow and clear. There was an abbey, and perhaps also the remnant of the nunnery to which Guinevere came from Winchester Camelot when the round table of King Arthur broke up. An enclosure, then, as stripped of human presence as that damp stone ruin on the Droveway, the stone ruin surrounded by sycamores that, ignoring the decay and death of the house they were intended to shelter, continued to grow, casting a cold shade on the black, grassless earth. As stripped as that far-off ruin, this emptiness within the tall box hedge, just a few steps from my cottage, where, if Bray was right, religious men or women of another age, renouncers of the world, perhaps, pampered people, possibly also half-prisoners, had taken the air, or told their beads, secluded in the medieval huddle of a village, between the village centre of church and churchyard, and the busy river and wet fields, water meadows, busy with peasant labour turning over the heavy, rich, black earth. At the end of this enclosure was the orchard. Old, even decayed, it stood among older forest trees, and the box hedge here was straggly. At the exit the top branches did not meet to form an arch. From here, until the summer green hid it, the river and the willows could be seen across the water meadows, not cropped now, the meadows, no hay taken off them, never busy, and closed even to cattle. No question of taking a short cut across the water meadows to the river. The land was permanently drowned, cut up by choked channels, and with the remnants, like minor Roman engineering ruins, of abandoned control hatches. It was said that the secrets of drowning and draining the meadows were now lost. Labours once as matter-of-fact and seasonal as, say, the water bailiff's cleaning of the river and cutting of the overlong river weeds, floating entanglingly up. Once the wealth of the valleys lay in the wet meadows, Now it lay more in the wide, unencumbered uplands. All that grew now in the manor meadows beyond the orchard, and were never cropped, were the wild yellow irises. On one side of the orchard, as you came into it from the enclosure, was like a wood. There were many tall, old forest trees, and the ground was choked with weeds and tree debris. Suitably, this wood was where the two-story thatched children's house was. I couldn't get to it in the spring. There was no path. Pitten cut a path here much later, and then it was a four-swathed path, first for the hand barrow with garden refuse, and then for the big caged barrow or trolley Pitten used to ferry dead leaves to the grass and leaf and flower graveyard he had established, out of everybody's sight, at the back of the children's house. This vegetable graveyard, or rubbish dump, Pitten described as a garden refuge, and a certain amount of ingenuity went into finding or creating these hidden but accessible refuges. That was how Pitten used the word. I believe he had two or three such refuges at different places. Refuse, refuge. Two separate, unrelated words. But refuge, which Pitten used for refuse, did in the most remarkable way contain both words. Pitten's refuge not only stood for refuse, but also the additional idea or association, not at all inappropriate, of asylum, sanctuary, hiding, almost of hide-and-seek, of things kept decently out of sight and mind. He might say of a fallen beech branch on the lawn, or a heap of grass clippings, "I'll be going to the refuge," or "I'll take it down to the refuge presently." I thought at first that it was only Pitten's way with the word, but then I discovered that it was more or less common usage in the valley. I heard it from Bray, the car hire man, Pitten's neighbour. I heard it from him at the time the council workers went on strike for a week or so, or, as little printed notices pinned to trees and bus stops up and down the valley said, the council workers had decided to take industrial action. "No refuge this week," Bray said, meaning that there was to be no refuse collection. "You don't have to tell me who's behind this. It's the commonest among them. Communist in name and in deed." I also heard the word from Mr. Phillips's father. After the death of his wife, the old man sometimes came on a Saturday afternoon to visit, and also, Saturday being Pitten's day off, to walk through the grounds. He stopped sometimes in front of my cottage to talk. He had started life as a carrier's boy, and he was full of information about the old days. He told me why labourers' cottages beside the public road could be so very narrow. The old coach and cart roads had to be wide. When they were paved, they became narrower, and there were strips of ground on either side which for a time were nobody's property. Labourers squatted on these strips and built their cottages. He told me why so many had elder hedges, and why the hedges could be so mounded up and high. Elder grew fast, and a hedge was a squatter's way of staking out his claim. The hedges were high, not with the vegetable growth of centuries, as I had imagined, but with the imperishable household rubbish of the last century. Many of the hedge mounds had been built up with bottles and metal, junk and old shoes, rubbish that couldn't be got rid of. And the old man explained, "There was no refuge in those days, you see." And I heard the word again, from the neat, well-dressed and anxious man who came to deal with a plague of mice that scuttled about the ceiling of my bedroom, sounding at times as though they were pushing or rolling little pebbles back and forth. This man told me all he knew about rats and mice. Rats were terrors, but they were creatures of habit. They had their runs and could be caught. Mice, on the other hand, could live in small cracks or cavities in a wall. They never pined for light or a freer life. They could live on a gram of food a day, a crumb of biscuit. But the man's heart wasn't in the mouse hell or purgatory or mouse nullity he was describing. Once he might have spoken the words with relish and enjoyed the response of his listener. Now he, the mouse expert, spoke by rote. He was worried about his health. He had had a heart attack quite suddenly one day when he was laying down some poison for some mice. He was worried above all about his job, worried that the government or the local authority might close down his little department altogether and put the mice and vermin business out to contract with a private firm. Suddenly, with an accusing stab of the finger, he said with a use of the word that was as two-edged and apt for him as Pitten's refuge was for Pitten, "Do you know the next thing to go? The next thing to go will be refuge. Soon there'll be no public refuge in this place." To one side, then, as you came out into the orchard, were the children's house, and Pitten's refuge, as yet unreachable by a path since that had not been cut. To the other side lay the great manor gardens, filling first the space between the water meadows and the vegetable garden, and then the space between the water meadows and the manor. Nestlings cheeped in the knot-holes in the old orchard trees. Last year's nut-shells, the work of grey squirrels, were crunchy on the nut-walk that linked the orchard and the big manor lawn. The nut-walk ran beside the vegetable garden. The slender boughs of the nut-trees had been bent with old skill, or at least before Pitten's time, to meet above. Still visible among the fast-growing nettles and wild rose growth was the stone path around the old rose-beds. Then came the lawn proper. And here, fearful of intruding, in spite of what the Phillipses said, I walked at the very edge, beside the water meadow. The water meadow or marsh had already clearly claimed part of what had once been cultivated garden. Certain decorative trees, pink hawthorns especially, now grew in the marsh and were surrounded by marsh debris and vegetation. Many of the marsh plants, and especially the reeds which might have been planted at one time for the beauty, like Chinese or Japanese calligraphy, of their spear-like leaves, many of these plants had jumped the path Pitten had tried to keep clear at the edge of the wet meadow and seeded themselves in the lawn, like the trash from a sugarcane fire jumping a fire break and sending arrows of flame into the adjoining green field. The lawn sloped gently up all the way to the house. In the middle there was a big evergreen tree that must have been older than the house. The quarters and little terrace of Mr. and Mrs. Phillips, with washing on the terrace, were at one side, behind some statuary. The house was not old. It had been built early in the century, but built to look old. Like the reconstructed church across the lawn from my cottage, it was part of the taste of the time for a special idea of the past. The assertion, with the wealth and power of an unbelievably extensive empire, of racial and historical and cultural virtue. The back of the house made a grey impression. Grey stone, mottled and mildewed. I never looked very hard at the back facade. There was my wish not to intrude. And there was another reason. I didn't know the internal arrangements, and didn't know from which window my landlord, with his limitless time, his long empty days, might be looking out. He would have looked out on something like perfection. The lawn with the great tree in the foreground, the forest or wood to one side, the beaten-down water meadow beyond this lawn, with all the growth of willow and reeds and bamboo clumps and dogwood, and the shrubs that loved water, the river with its river growths, the water meadows beyond, the willows, the channels, the drowned fields catching the morning light, and, at a sufficient distance, the evening light, and then the bare downs again. And what effects of moonlight on these water meadows, with the moon rising above the bare downs? What effect on a moonlight night of river and mist? There were only a few acres, relatively speaking, attached to the manor now. The land just beyond the river belonged to another landowner. But by a series of accidents, the water meadows no longer needed for pasture, the shrinking of the small valley villages with the mechanization of agriculture at the end of the last century, the disappearance of many agricultural cottages, the taking over by the military of the distant bare downs. By these and other accidents, the view from the back of the manor, the view through which I walked, was of a nature almost unchanged since Constable's day. A view without a house, without the peasant or river activity of the Middle Ages, or the age before the ploughing of the downs, a view almost of a nature park. And all this just a few miles from the famous old towns of Salisbury and Wilton, the modern urban clusters of Southampton and Andover, the red brick, old and new, of the Victorian railway town of Basingstoke, and the Victorian Gothic black brick ring around the cathedral heart of ancient Winchester. The toy village, of which my cottage formed part, was only an aspect, together with the children's thatched house in the pathless forest, of the greater design of the manor grounds. But perfection such as my landlord looked out on contained its own corruption. Perfection like that could too easily be taken for granted. There was nothing in that view of ivy and forest debris and choked water meadow which would irritate or encourage doubt. There was nothing in that view which would encourage action in a man already spiritually weakened by personal flaws, disappointments, and above all, his knowledge of his own great security. The view, so complete, so simple, seemed to say, or could appear to say, this is the world, Why worry? Why interfere? At the far end of the lawn, where a new wood began, offering little glimpses of hedges and overgrown paths and covered walks and stone urns, a wood which I was never to explore, at that end of the lawn there was a very large greenhouse. Its timber frame was solid, so solid that from a distance it all looked whole, a greenhouse in use. But the green behind the glass was the green of weeds growing unusually tall, in the protected conditions of the greenhouse, a wilderness of weeds, and many of the glass panels had fallen. To me, with what I knew of old Trinidad estate houses in the French Caribbean style, there was about this greenhouse something, over and above the fact of its size, that suggested wealth. It had been overspecified. Its timbers, the depth of the concrete floor, on two levels on the sloping site, its door, its hinges, its metalwork, everything was much sturdier than was strictly necessary. It was the way, perhaps without being asked, builders built for the rich, just as shopkeepers sent up their best to the big house. There was something very satisfying about this style of building. Everything seemed so much itself. Everything seemed built for long use. There was no fragility, no anxiety. Over the hill, Jack also had a greenhouse, at the back, or perhaps the front, of his cottage, facing the old farmyard. That greenhouse would have been bought from a catalogue, like those advertised in the magazines with the television or radio programmes. And how frail Jack's greenhouse had always looked, how slender its timber frame, how fragile its thin glass, even its floor of concrete. And indeed, when its time had come, how quickly it had all gone, all but the concrete floor. And even that had later disappeared. How quickly it had been cleansed of its greenhouse spirits. But this manor greenhouse, after two decades of neglect, still stood and from 50 yards still looked solid and whole, its timbers still painted, its thick concrete floor still uncracked, its door swinging easily on its hinges. It would have been the work of a day to clean it inside, and the work of less than a week to recommission it again, to replace its wilderness with order. Bush inside the great greenhouse. Bush outside. Pitten's lawnmower didn't come here until late in the season, and then, as everywhere else after the lawnmower had been, the grass showed level and flat and lawn-like and tended. But before that cut of Pitten's, it was necessary to hack through the nettles and the bush that grew thick and fast in the dampness to get to the first of the bridges that led across the water channels and creeks of the water meadow to the river bank. At the other end of the lawn, where the water meadow met the orchard, there was a barbed wire fence in a ditch, in the midst of the water bush, to deter intruders. At this end there was only bush and something like forest debris, but here, in the days of the old life of the manor, there had been a series of railed timber bridges over the channels, channels which, overgrown with willows that had then been blown down by equinoctial gales, had become like forest creeks, water appearing to be black over old leaves and mud, until you noticed the clear, clean colours of the leaves and the sky that the water reflected. In these hidden black creeks, so unlike the open meadows with yellow irises at the other end, there were often mallards. They took fright at one's approach, so used were they to their untroubled possession of these waters, or a particular willow-blocked arm of a creek. The bridges over the creeks of the water meadows had been built to high specifications, but over the years they had rotted in the water, and had been further broken up by the growth of vegetable matter, even sturdy, tall-stalked nettles, and especially by the growth of the roots and trunks of willows. There still remained, that first spring of my walks and discoveries, a heavy gate at the end of the first bridge. This gate dragged, but its posts, though black and green with damp and disagreeable to the touch, still stood, and the gate could still be pulled shut and latched with a rusting catch. As a gate, a barrier, it was meaningless. The levels of ground and water had changed. The gate no longer guarded a dry walk across the water meadow. One could simply walk around the gate. There was a merest dip in the ground now, and the only inconvenience came from the nettles. But the nettles were everywhere. At one stage of this cross-meadow walk, the weeds and reeds and willows and other wild growths were so tall it was hard to see the river. Then, quite suddenly, from the very last bridge, with many broken planks, big rusted nails alone remaining whole, the planks they had fixed having rotted away altogether, suddenly, from the last bridge, the end of the bush was clear, and the trimmed path, along the riverbank, beside the collapsed boathouse. This boathouse was a spectacular ruin. The mooring for the boat or boats was in a creek, one of the old channels of the water meadow. The thick timber posts or pillars of the corrugated iron-roofed shelter stood on either side of the creek. But tame though the river looked, a few feet deep, a few feet wide, the water it channeled was a force of nature, not wholly predictable, and the banks of that river and its inlets were constantly changing. The boathouse creek, widening or simply shifting, had caused the boathouse to collapse on one side. The angle of collapse, the rotting timber, the black-looking water, the rusting, corrugated iron suggested a tropical river ruin, somewhere on the Orinoco or Amazon or the Congo. And yet, passing this ruin and as though belonging to another order of nature, another order of society almost, was the trimmed path along the riverbank. It was to that easy path, a path for fishermen, that the water meadow bridges were meant to lead. And the river itself flowed tidily and gently, and neat planks bridged the channels from the wet meadows to the main river. It was the hand of man, the hand of the water bailiffs and people like them, that suggested an orderly nature. Left to itself, the river, like the water meadow at the back of the manor, would have become a forest ruin. It took only one collapsed willow, blown down during a gale, say, to create a mess in the river, the banks wrecked, easy passage gone, tangled islands of river weeds and river dross with rippled skins of milky brown scum, building up in a few days between the branches. The colour of the river depended on what grew on the banks, and small though the scale was, the bank was varied. Where there were tall reeds or grasses on the water's edge, and the bank was overhung with trees, and if there were little indentations, miniature coves, in the bank, then the water was dark green, deep-seeming and mysterious. Where the bank was clear, the water was clear, showing the white sand or chalk of the bed, or the rippling green river weeds. There came a stage on my walk along the riverbank when I stood directly in front of the water meadow where the yellow irises grew. Beyond that was the old orchard, with a box enclosure that lay to one side of my cottage. Above the orchard and the vegetable garden wall, I saw the roof and chimneys of my own cottage below the beeches, and was surprised all over again, every time, that that was where I lived. Not far beyond this point, the walk that was permitted to me came to an end. Beyond that was another river beat, belonging to another landowner, and though it would have been easy to climb over the makeshift fence, I preferred not to do so. The river curved here. On the opposite bank, the down ended abruptly in a wooded cliff, giving a great depth and a hint of surrounding forest to the river colour. There was also a new channel here from the bare down, a spring breaking out of the chalk and quickly turning into a noisy cascade, so that again in this neat, tame, smooth landscape, with a bare, green-white down and with a river a few feet deep divided neatly into numbered beats, there was a reminder of the unpredictable force of water. Old corrugated iron sheets served as hatches in the new channel, an unexpected touch in a landscape without people of the urban slum. The water bailiffs had released young trout near here, and they hadn't wandered far. They were unexpectedly unattractive, as nervous as rats, of that colour as well, and as swift and devious and silent as rats as they made for the camouflage of the dark river weeds. This was the river walk. Barely 10 minutes, hardly a walk to someone used to walking most days for about an hour and a half, but the walk was always new. The river and what I saw always changed. There was the blue iris I saw in my first spring, solitary among the weeds and nettles at the edge of the water meadow. I was transported at the sight and instantly had the wish, if I ever were to plant a garden of my own, to try to achieve that effect. And then, in the light-headedness of my convalescence, I began, until I sobered up again, to walk through the nettles to the iris, as though the beauty of what I saw lay not in the setting, but in that particular iris. There were the scented old roses in the wild rose-bed, and the roses I saw that first summer were the last. I was in at that particular death. Because in the autumn Mrs. Phillips pruned them, cut them right back, as she said, and those old rose bushes, cut down to the quick, all turned to briar again. There was a time of the spring or summer, every year, when a pale blue lawn weed floated like a blue mist above the daisy-spotted lawn, and always there was the river. It was the river with its overwhelming beauty of reeds and weeds and moving water and changing reflections, that made me say, long before I felt myself in tune with other plants and truly in tune with the seasons, at least I've had a year of this, and then at least I've had 2 years of this. And just as, on the walk over the downs past Jack's cottage, I always in the beginning looked for the warm brown fur of the hares, so on this shorter river walk I looked for the miniature volcano of the salmon's nest in the white chalk of the riverbed, and the still dark pike waiting in a deep pool where the water was dark in the shadow of reeds, and I looked for the vole, or water rat. I knew the little tree on whose lower branch he liked to sun himself after shaking his fur. I often saw him swimming across the river, and once I saw him so soundly asleep that, thinking he was dead, I went and stood over him. I often heard the surprised plop of his fellows as they dived into their river holes, sending up silent, muddy clouds. Every winter and spring created fresh havoc in the manor gardens and water meadows. The bridges over the channels decayed and decayed. The gate at the very last, or the first, bridge was eventually left open 1 year and collapsed finally of its own rot. The river changed its course by a few feet, washing over the path that the water bailiffs had kept clear, and the planks that spanned the channels were lost below water. New 2-plank bridges were built, 1 plank plain, 1 covered with wire netting, for the grip it gave both to shoes and to the wheels of the bailiff's barrows. On this walk, as on the longer walk on the downs past Jack's cottage, I lived not with the idea of decay. That idea I quickly shed, so much as with the idea of change. I lived with the idea of change, of flux, and learned profoundly not to grieve for it. I learned to dismiss this easy cause of so much human grief. Decay implied an ideal, a perfection in the past, but would I have cared to be in my cottage while the 16 gardeners worked? When every growing plant aroused anxiety, every failure, pain, or criticism? Wasn't the place now, for me, at its peak? Finding myself where I was, I thought, after the journey that had begun so long before, that I was blessed. And then one day, quite unexpectedly, walking with freedom at the back of the manor, walking at the edge of both the ruined water meadow and the wild manor lawn, I saw my landlord. This was my second glimpse of my landlord. There never was to be another. And it was as confusing as my first when I had seen him sitting beside Mr. Phillips in the motor car, driving along the narrow road below the beeches planted by his father. I had barely seen him that time in the motor car, had barely had time to focus on him, and the car had moved on, leaving me with a more precise and surprising picture of Mr. Phillips. Happy, not at all irritable in the company of his master, more like an impresario, like a man who was fully himself, had a proper idea of his duties and worth. And just as after that first sighting my imagination had played with a half-impression of my landlord, now making him benign, now making him buttoned up, with dark glasses and the long hair of a Howard Hughes recluse, so now, because, being as nervous myself of being seen as he was, I turned away as soon as I saw him and never looked back. My memories were as much of the shock of the moment as of the man I had glimpsed. I saw him from a great distance, almost as soon as I had walked past the old rose-bed, without roses now, a briar wilderness long after that first summer of thorny, densely petalled, scented lilac-pink roses, and had stepped onto the lawn proper, full of daisies. He was sitting in the pool of sunlight between the great evergreen that shaded much of the lawn, the big, partly broken greenhouse, and the wood at the side of the house, through which I had seen little paths, which I had never explored, for fear of intruding, for fear of disturbing my landlord, for fear of something very like this moment. He was sitting, as I thought or felt afterwards, in a canvas-backed, easy chair, in the sunlight, facing south, with his back to me. He was wearing a wide-brimmed hat. That hat obscured the shape or the baldness or otherwise of his head, just as the canvas back of his chair obscured the bulk or otherwise of his back or torso. From the first sighting I had had of him I had retained one clear physical detail, the little low wave he had given against the dashboard of his car. I had invested that wave with his shyness, the shyness of his illness, the shyness that went at the same time, as I thought, with a great vanity, a shyness that wasn't so much a wish not to be seen as a wish to be applauded on sight, to be recognised on sight as someone stupendous and of interest, and I'd also invested that wave with his benevolence. From this second glimpse, I again retained just one clear physical detail. It was of his crossed leg and his bare bent knee, shining in the sun. He was wearing shorts. They were tight around the plump thigh, I saw. This wish of my landlord for nakedness and physical self-cherishing, stories had come my way from the Phillipses and from Bray, the car hire man whose father had worked in the manor long ago, of the great beauty of my landlord as a young man. This idea of beauty and the flesh now went with an opposite reality, the fatness of self-indulgence and inactivity. It is that detail, the pool of sunlight in the wilderness, the sun on the fat, shining leg, that fixes the season for me. I knew, of course, that he kept to his room in the cold weather and went out of doors only in fine weather. He had been granted at birth a great house and a wide view in the dampest part of the county on the river bank, in a valley, which often, looking down from the viewing point on my other walk, I had seen covered entirely with mist. But his instincts were Mediterranean, tropical. He loved the sun. Inertia, habit, friendships, a wish to be where his worth was known. Perhaps these things had kept him in his inherited house. Perhaps if he could have taken friends and social connections, the knowledge in others of his social worth, everything that protected him, he might have moved. But he stayed in his house, which was his setting, and dreamed of being elsewhere, dreamed in his own way. He had sent me poems, in my first year as his tenant, about Krishna and Shiva. Mrs. Phillips had typed the poems out, and then she had brought them over in person to the cottage. It was my landlord's gesture of welcome to me, and so Mrs. Phillips treated it, adding to the gesture her own surprising reverence for the act of poetry-making. Mrs. Phillips typed out and brought over more poems. She became, as it were, the living link between my landlord and me. I don't think he intended the courtesy to be quite like that, but that was how it fell out, and it made my settling into the cottage very much easier. Krishna and Shiva. There, beside that river, constable and shepherd, in those grounds. There was nothing of contemporary cult or fashion in my landlord's use of these divinities. His Indian romance was in fact older, even antiquated, something he had inherited, like his house, something from the days of imperial glory, when, out of material satiety and the expectation of the world's continuing to be ordered as it had been ordered for a whole century and more, power and glory had begun to undo themselves from within. Ruskinism, a turning away from the coarseness of industrialism, upper class or cultivated sensibilities, sensibilities almost drugged by money, the yellow book, philosophy melting away into sensuousness, sensation. My landlord's Indian romance partook of all of those impulses and was rooted in England, wealth, empire, the idea of glory, material satiety, a very great security. His Indian romance, which had very little to do with me, my past, my life, or my ambitions, suited his setting. His Krishna and Shiva were names, and in his poems they were like Greek divinities, given the colour of antique sculpture, literally touched with night blue, the colour of wantonness, the promise of a pleasure and beauty and Keatsian truth that made the senses reel. The conceit about the painted statues was pleasing. I felt it was an old poem, and there was knowledge of a sort of the blue aboriginal gods of the Hindu pantheon, the lascivious Krishna, the drug-taking Shiva, blue standing, in fact, for the black of the aboriginal inhabitants of India. But in later poems, some typed by Mrs. Phillips, some printed, single sheets with drawings, a similar heady sensuousness was attributed to Italian youths of apparently the previous century, or young Conradian sailors, again of apparently the previous century, in Peruvian or Malayan or Brazilian ports. His fantasies, sensual rather than explicitly sexual to judge by the poems, were unconfined but also unfocused, a warm blur, something that was owed him but which perhaps might disappear with definition, something out there, outside himself, and eventually an aspect of his acedia, the curious death of the soul that had befallen him so early in his life. His anchor was his house, his knowledge of his social worth. Through all the ups and downs of his illness, or his acedia, the knowledge of who he was remained with him. All the poems he had sent by Mrs. Phillips had been signed, extravagantly. There was about his signature, in addition to its size, something of the experimental nature of a boy's signature. It spoke of someone still savouring his personality. And now he sat before me, in a pool of sunlight in the grounds of his house, the house he had known all his life, next to the broken, paned, weed-filled greenhouse, in the ruin of his garden. Semi-nude, his legs crossed, the fat right thigh, the thigh that was raised and which I saw, tightly encased in his shorts. It was the Phillipses who had encouraged me to walk through the back garden and along the riverbank, pooh-poohing as an unnecessary delicacy my wish to walk at the very limit of the lawn beside the water meadow. Their own visitors were less circumspect. My landlord had his own patch, they told me. It was somewhere at the end of those overgrown walks through the wood at the far side of the house. I could walk with freedom. And I had done so for some years. I had certainly been observed by my landlord from one of the manor windows, and I believe that in his appearing where he was, there might have been an element of willfulness. His movements out of the house were major affairs. Someone would have had to take the chair out for him, for instance, and perhaps it was out of a wish to show him, for his pettishness, his petulance, that neither Mr. Phillips nor his wife had told me that my landlord was sitting out in the back garden that day. His house, his garden, his view, his name. What did he see? Whatever he saw would have been different from what I saw. And so, after learning and possessing that view and the river for so many seasons, I was suddenly shocked, suddenly felt an intruder, as much as I did when one day Bray, the car hire man in a special nostalgic mood, he had been quarrelling with his wife and with Pitten, the manor gardener who was his next-door neighbour, showed me a social magazine of the 1920s, and I had seen a handsome, self-aware group of young people of the period sitting on the rails of one of the bridges over the creeks between the back lawn and the river. Another view, another place. What did he see, sitting there in his canvas-backed chair? Did he see the tall weeds in the solid greenhouse? The tops of some of the weeds flattened against the glass. Was he agitated by the wish to put things right, or by the idea of decay and lack of care? Did he see the ivy that was killing so many of the trees that had been planted with the garden? He must have seen the ivy. Mrs. Phillips told me one day that he liked ivy, and had given instructions that the ivy was never to be cut. What were his feelings, then, when a tree collapsed? So many trees had collapsed. Such a wilderness now ruled in the water meadows, such a forest litter with so many fallen willows, and the exposed Norfolk reeds then laid flat by the floods of a winter that for a week or so had cut an extra channel through the meadows on the opposite bank. He liked flowers. Pitten grew flowers for him in a corner of the walled vegetable garden, and from what I heard, he became passionate for flowers as soon as the weather brightened. He could not always wait for the flowers Pitten grew. He insisted then, after his winter seclusion, on going out to flower shops in Salisbury and other towns, sometimes making long journeys to certain favoured garden centres to buy flowers and plants in pots. It was Pitten who reported to me that, on the way back from one of the flower expeditions, my landlord had seen the peonies below my window, and in the shade of the yew hedge, and had felt as I did about the depth of colour of the overshadowed peonies. Pitten, reporting this to please me, found himself in a quandary. The difficulty lay in my landlord's pronunciation of the word peony. Pitten didn't want to be disloyal to his employer. "He doesn't say peony, like you or me," Pitten said. "He says peony." The word in this pronunciation rhymed with pony. Somewhere, was it at Oxford, or was it in the pages of Somerset Maugham, I had read or heard of this Edwardian affectation, an affectation known to be an affectation. Balcony, rhyming with pony, and peony, rhyming with pony. And the affectation that Pitten reported was strange. Like my landlord's knowledge of the value of his name, this affectation, the badge of a particular group, this class lesson from another age, had survived his desperate illness, his acedia. And Forgetting this affectation, how did his taste for flowers go with the ruin of his own garden, the ruin through which, from his windows, he would have often seen me walking? Did he, in fact, see decay? Or did he, since vegetable growth never stopped, simply see lushness? Or did he cherish the decay,